Well, hello everyone. Welcome to Infection Control Matters. And Phil and Martin.
Still in Barcelona.
Yeah. Still in Barcelona.
And stopped raining, which is nice.
Mm. Yeah.
And we thought today we were going to... We alluded to this in an earlier podcast about the WHO releasing a guideline called indoor airborne risk assessment. It came out a couple of weeks ago. And it was a description of airborne transmission mechanisms and a new model for risk assessment. Now, it was developed in the context of SARS-CoV-2, but I think the idea is it's a test case, perhaps, for new ways to describe modes of transmission.
Yeah. So I get the feeling they went through all of our podcasts on new paradigms.
Yes.
A couple of years ago.
I thought we'd better do something about it.
Yeah. Maybe not quite. But who chaired the group?
So the chair of the group was Lydia Maraska.
Okay.
It was a large group of individuals. And later on in this podcast, you'll hear, we caught up with Kath Noakes about her take on the guideline.
Yeah, Kath's a professor of engineering from Leeds University, and she's been on the podcast in the past, as has Lydia.
As probably a few other people who are involved
in
this, contributed to this guideline. So we'll hear from Kath shortly. The idea really is to change some of the terminology that we have and been traditionally using in IPC land.
So the droplet is dead, long live the particle.
Long live the particle.
Yeah.
So infectious respiratory
particles.
Long float the particle. Yeah. Well, we'll talk about how long in a minute. infectious respiratory particles are the way to describe particles, which may be of different sizes. And use that as a term rather than aerosols, rather than droplets.
Yeah.
So it's an all-encompassing term.
Yeah.
So it can be big or small particles.
It could be big, or small.
Because as you'll hear from Kath in a while, and I don't want to steal all the thunder, but large particles can cover quite long distances in air as well, because there's a lot more than just gravity involved in
this. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
The guideline's available on the WHO website, and now we've got something in the background. So the three transmission routes proposed.
Mm-hmm.
Contact transmission. I think we all are familiar with contact transmission, but contact transmission involving direct body-to-surface or body-surface contact with a physical transfer of microorganisms between infected or colonized persons and a susceptible host. Indirect contact transmission involves, as you'd expect, contact with a susceptible host with a contaminated intermediate object, e.g. contaminated hands. So basically, contact transmission, as pretty much as we've always described it, direct and indirect. And then the change really is the next two, which are direct deposition transmission and airborne or inhalation transmission.
Yeah.
So the direct deposition transmission, DDT.
DDT.
I just made that up. I don't think I actually call it DDT.
It might get mixed up with some insecticide from years ago.
Yeah.
And this is where infectious respiratory particles are directly deposited into the conjunctivae and mucous membranes of the upper respiratory tract. So mouth, nose, pharynx. And they're deposited into a susceptible host following a projectile motion of emission from the infected person.
In other words, standing in full force of a sneeze.
Yes.
A sneeze or a cough, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. And this mode occurs at close proximity.
Yeah.
Mm, okay.
So, look.
Wear a shield.
Wear a shield. Mm. Wear...
eye protection.
Yeah.
Mouth protection.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, that's... that one's pretty much...
direct deposit transmission.
Yes. Okay. Direct deposition.
Deposition.
Yeah.
So you're depositing something infectious.
Yeah.
Into your mucosa.
That when I sneeze.
Yeah.
I'm just going to make a deposition.
Yeah.
Make a deposition. Yeah. I'm going to struggle to remember that deposition. Well, I might remember it now.
Yeah.
And the third one, which we just mentioned before, was the airborne or inhalation transmission.
Yeah.
And this is where you get the aerosolized infectious respiratory particles are inhaled and enter the respiratory tract through the upper and lower parts of the respiratory tract. This mode of transmission can occur when infectious respiratory particles have traveled either a short or long distance after emission from an infected person. So they have defined this into short and long-term range airborne transmission.
And what it does talk about is all the things that could affect long-term range, like ventilation rates, atmospheric conditions, like the pace, humidity, all sorts of things, really. So it just shows you how complicated it is.
Mm.
But probably not as complicated as the negotiation it took to get
those new wordings.
Because there's quite a few different people on this group with quite long held and forceful views, and
Of both persuasions.
Both persuasions. So there's been a certain amount of negotiation, which I'm sure is the art of not losing face. So it's considering, actually, we're still, now 5 years on, but not quite.
Mm.
I suppose that's quite rapid.
It is quite rapid. And the other thing, I guess, we alluded to in earlier podcasts here at ECMID, that these guidelines, and in Kath Noakes' talk, she referred to ventilation really being key for that longer-term transition. That is more than greater than 2 metres. One of the things they have in the guideline is some really interesting graphics. I think the graphics have been really well and carefully thought about. And so I reckon they'll be useful for training and education material, educational related.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it's a more complicated series of processes to get over to the healthcare worker on the street, if you like.
Yeah.
So it's finding good ways of putting that into something meaningful.
Communication.
In communication.
Yeah. So are these out for discussion, Thresh, or are these are done?
These are done, but I suspect that this isn't an infection control guide.
No.
This is a ventilation related
indoor air transmission. They actually haven't talked about what the recommendation is to, if that's the case, precautions, that's not in it.
It does
say that it will complicate matters. Putting it mildly, I think there's still going to be a lot of discussion about what level of mask we need, etc. But if we're talking about tiny particles floating through the air for long distances, personally, I don't think a surgical mask is going to cut it. Especially if you've got a novel virus while you're still trying to work out if you can even vaccinate against it.
So the IPC work really needs to come out.
It really does.
And I suspect this has probably come out so that it could test the water too. I suspect there's a degree of that.
Good the conversation starts.
That's right. At least we've got to have a starting point here.
Yeah.
There's a really nice little graphic that talks about the inhalation transmission route in more detail. So, and it talks about five factors that influence the I've got to get this term. I keep going to say airborne, but it's the inhalation transmission.
Yes. it's quite odd.
Yeah. Mm. Five factors. And these make sense. Look, they're logical, but it's nice to actually see them graphically. And again, this will be probably nothing new, but emission rate. This is at the person level.
Mm-hmm.
Things that might affect it. Yeah, respiratory rate, how much physical activity you're doing. Whether you've got a source control, whether the person's wearing surgical mask or whatever, N95 mask.
Does like vocal activity come into that? Like singing and shouting?
Yes, voice amplitude.
Okay.
That's a good way to describe that. And so also then thinking about how infectious, I guess, they are. So how particle emissions, what stage are they? The viral load is another factor. So that's the first consideration and the sub-considerations. Then there's removal rate. So this is broken into a couple of things, like dilution. So, if you're in a bigger area and all that kind of stuff. And the interpersonal distance. So that goes to the point earlier about...
There's no 2 metres now.
There's not a time.
If I'm at 1.99 metre, I'm in trouble, and 2.01, fine.
So don't hang around with close talkers.
We've got to
have... Especially a shout.
Yeah. Shout and spit at the same time. There's a few of those around. And so some of the factors that have influenced this, indoor ventilation, relative humidity, temperature, biological decay of the virus, survival times, gravitational settings, all that kind of thing. So how much is going to get out and hang around, I guess, is... Then there's exposure is the third consideration. So that's about distances, proximity, time, being in contact with other people, all that kind of exposure in the room, all those kinds of factors that... makes sense. Then the absorbed dose. So you guess this is where you've inhaled the infectious respiratory particle.
Mm-hmm.
And That's things like the deposition fraction.
It's going to be so easy to explain to people.
It is, isn't it? And physical activity. So it's basically, to me, this is how much you're getting into your respiratory tract. Yeah. And all the variable things that affect that, including exposure time and mask use and how much virus is actually on the particle and where is it going to get to. And then the fifth and final, which is all the ones we're familiar with in the normal chain of infection as well. I mean, this isn't too dissimilar to a chain of infection for all infectious system.
At what stage of the disease process the person who's donating the particle?
Well, I think that's a stage one, because that's okay. The viral, that's the exposure.
Yeah, but you know, me on day one, I'm giving out a lot more than I am on day 10.
Yeah, so that goes into that emission rate.
Yeah, you know, because all the RPE used for people in critical care, they were 2 weeks in. Yeah. Probably not infectious as the people at the front end in the accident emergency department that we were lot more infectious. Yeah. So
in that emission rate, they talk about viral copies. And then the fifth and final is the probability of infection. You know, so that's dose response, vaccination, host immunity, all that kind of stuff. Mm.
You can build a hell of a mathematical model for any situation. Just build an app on your phone. Going into that room there, let me have a quick scan around. Let me look at my risk factor.
Do you know what? That's the actual...
There's the algorithm.
There is actually... Yeah. For my take on this is that they plan to do... There is an online tool that they're developing or have developed. I think they're developing to be able to model the risks based on all these different factors.
Yeah.
But they do allude that there's massive gaps in understanding all those things. So if you just use that example, I guess, of, well, what would be an acceptable, but how would we measure even if someone's got SARS-CoV-2? Viral replication that's coming out of them, or the RNA copies of the virus coming out of them, how would we measure that?
Yeah, I know.
So all these models.
Now you're not admitting that. You go over there. You're getting negative pressure. Yeah.
I mean, so it's all well and good to have this, and I'm not knocking the guidelines, not at all, but
the future may bring things.
But that's the point. Until you do this, then you can say we actually need to plug these gaps, and that's where maybe innovation, technology, research down the track. But as you alluded to, Phil, the big thing then will be the infection control. How do you operationalize this document into guidelines?
Yeah.
Practically, what does this mean?
Yeah. Basically, this is you're on your own then.
Off you go.
For now.
So, I
get the problem for the WHO is they're providing a guideline, or they're trying to make a recommendation for all countries, and what a middle and low income country might be able to do might be different from a high income country. So they might do something with a bit more common sense than many high income countries, but you know, you can't say this is the minimum standard of a particular mask when a lot of countries in the world just won't be able to get it. So therefore you set a minimum and then say, but if you can go to a higher, possibly, I don't know, we'll see what they come up.
And now we're going to hear from Martin. You caught up with Professor Kath Lutz, so we'll hear from her now.
Okay. So I'm here with Professor Catherine Noakes from the University of Leeds, who gave a very nice session yesterday on ventilation in hospitals. And I spoke to Brett about it afterwards, and we thought we'd try and grab you and ask what you think of the new WHO change in terminology.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, I think it's taken a while. I kind of understand why it's taken a while, because this was a really complicated issue in a sense. You know, in some respects perhaps it's not complicated, perhaps we've managed to simplify it, but I think, you know, it's about hearts and minds, some of this.
Well, it's the views of people that make it complicated.
Yeah, so it's the views of people and the understanding of people. So I think there are some really good things in there. I think one of the things that's really good is it's recognizing now we've not now got this sort of magic 5 micron diameter cutoff where something suddenly magically turns from an aerosol into a droplet, which was always a bit of a misnomer, and actually recognizing now we've got this spectrum of particles and that the bigger ones can stay in the air for longer as part of that. So I think that's an important part. I think it's also really important that we're recognizing that when you're close to somebody, transmission is through the air and is through inhalation, and therefore we can call it airborne transmission, as well as when it's over a longer distance. Because I think, you know, the idea that airborne transmission only happens when you're further away and when you're close it's something magically different, again, is wrong. And I think, I really hope that change in terminology there really helps us understand helps us communicate, I guess, that transmission when you're close can be through some very small particles that you inhale, and they're much more concentrated when they're closer.
Yeah. I mean, it does a nice job of listing all the factors.
It recognises that complexity, because I think it's human nature, isn't it? We try and simplify things.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, when we simplify things, we miss stuff along the way.
Yeah.
And to try and now recognise that. And I think this is now the next step, because, of course, it's one thing recognising that, setting some terminology, but actually, as WHO said in their webinar about it, this is the start of the beginning.
Yes.
You've now got to take this forward and think really through, what does this mean?
Yes.
What does it mean for different pathogens?
It was a bit light on that, wasn't it, on recommendations?
And I understand that, because actually, I think that will take a long time.
It really will.
And it's better to start now and then move that process forward, because you're not going to, just because we've now recognised some changes, doesn't mean you're suddenly going to have one size fits all on your infection control measures.
No.
We've got to recognise how different pathogens move. We've got to recognise how that affects different cohorts of people. We've got to think about the practicalities of environments, and what you might do in some settings might not be feasible in other settings.
Yes. Yeah. And I quite like the human behaviour aspects of this, yes, recognising that shouting and singing makes a big difference to the way air moves, you know, because that was all a bit denied at the beginning. And I think that initial choir outbreak that said everything,
yeah,
really.
It did. But I think the other thing, so one of the things that's had a little bit of flack is people talking about puff clouds.
I know, I was going to ask you about that, because I saw it on Twitter recently, saying, what's a puff cloud?
Yeah.
But actually, then I was sitting outside a bar yesterday, as you do, seeing people vape, and you get a puff cloud.
You get a puff cloud.
And I'm going, okay.
Do it yourself. When it's cold day, breathe outside, you'll see it. You see that you get this breath, and you'll see it hang in the air for a few seconds before it disperses off. And remember, even after you can't see it, it might still be hanging a bit there. But it doesn't,
it's just got smaller, presumably.
Yeah, it doesn't go sort of magically across the whole room instantly. There's a gradient. And so when somebody breathes out, you get this like jet initially. You get the ballistic droplets, they go really fast to the floor, like a fraction of a second.
Yeah.
But the other stuff, even the bigger stuff, will hang in the air for a few seconds. And we don't breathe absolutely continuously. We breathe out in pulses.
Hmm.
So you get these little clouds.
Hmm.
And if you cough, they can shoot quite a long way, and they stay clustered together. And that clustering of droplets, particles, I've said droplets there.
You
I
did.
Shouldn't say
yes,
that.
No.
You have to remember.
I'll have to bleep that out.
Respiratory, infectious respiratory particles.
Yeah.
Those, like, when they're clustered, I always think that might be the most dangerous bit. You know, you're walking past that. You've done it in the street, haven't you? You walk past somebody who breathes out a vape, and you breathe in, and you get this big mouthful of it.
Yeah.
And it's a sort of chance effect thing, but I think we ought to think about that. The risk, I think, with something like puff clouds is, have we just now introduced another term that people don't understand, and a term for invisible things when we're all talking about invisible things all the time?
Yeah. I mean, so I suppose if you put the analogy of seeing a cloud of vapour, that can make a difference. I mean, is there some evidence? I remember reading something somewhere that's saying a CO2 level in the room can keep actually particles concentrated at around a particular height, which may even increase risk to us.
So I think that's another really big factor, which is air doesn't mix fully in a room.
Mm.
And sometimes you get what you call stratification.
Yeah.
In fact, you get that, think of a cold morning, you know, when you see like the mist above a field,
mm-hmm,
and you get those layers of mist.
Yeah.
You can sometimes get the same thing happen in a room.
Okay.
So potentially you create sort of concentrations which stay higher concentration over longer distances. The other thing that I think is important, which we're not really looking at, is things like a fan in a room or an air conditioner, because when the air's more turbulent, higher velocity, you can carry stuff further.
Yes.
Think about how far things carry outside. Leaves carry in the wind.
Yeah.
They're massive.
Yes, I've noticed that every autumn. Next door but one's willow is a killer.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Indoors, the air's really, it's not still by any means, but the flows are very slow. But you put a fan in there, you could increase the airflow. So you create directional flows.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of cases, a couple of COVID-19 outbreaks, where you can see the pattern of the outbreak matches where an air conditioner or a fan was moving the air.
Yeah.
And it's almost like exactly.
I can vividly remember a norovirus outbreak where we're getting more staff affected than patients. And I went in on Saturday morning because that's when you see where infection control is really happening. And they've got a norovirus patient in a side room with the door open so they can observe them with a fan. The fan's pointing out the door, and on the nurse base is a pile of toast for the staff to eat. So it's just coating their toast with norovirus. And you know, well, yeah. if you're doing that, I'm afraid you deserve everything you get. Okay.
But the hard thing about the air is we can't see it.
No.
And so even when it's got pathogens in it, we can't see them.
No.
And finding ways to help people visualise that, I think that's going to be an important next step. Mm. And there is a role, things like simulations can play quite a big role there, but a lot of, which is something for people like me to deal with, a lot of the simulations we produce are too complicated to show people visually. We ought to be thinking about how we can use those to explain things to people in a simpler way.
Same issue in infection prevention. How do you convince people that an invisible substance on your hands
precisely
was an issue? And that's what some of us struggled with. Yeah. You know, he couldn't convince people something invisible no one could see would kill people.
Absolutely. Yeah. So. And, you know, I mean, visible dirt is a starting proxy, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's not the only proxy.
No, it's not the only proxy. But actually a nice analogy.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Kath. Really enjoyed
You're
that.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
That was a great chat, Martin, with Kath. A lot there for us to consider.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, I'm sure there'll be more to come on this topic, and we'll probably explore this a bit more as we digest it a bit more.
Yeah. Mm.
A few textbook chapters to rewrite and educational programs to be
debate redone. Still to be had, but at least I think it's on firmer ground now.
Yeah. Good chatting.
Okay, everybody.
See you, everyone. Bye-bye.